This is Fresh Air. There aren't many French horn players in jazz. Willie Ruff is one of the better known. He was featured on the classic Miles Davis Gil Evans album Miles Ahead. Billy Strayhorn wrote a composition for Ruff, and he's performed around the world with his musical partner of many years, pianist Dwight Mitchell. The duo was the subject of a recent book by William Zinsser. Now Ruff has expanded on the story with his autobiography, A Call to Assembly. It tells the story of growing up in the segregated South, coming of age in the segregated army, going north to study at Yale, and years later returning to Yale as a teacher. Before we meet Ruff, let's listen to the Mitchell-Ruff duo playing Ill Wind from their new recording, Virtuoso Elegance in Jazz. Is really the story of a life, and I want to go back to what was quite a turning point in your young life, and that is when you were age 13 growing up in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Your mother died of tuberculosis.
Right.
Your father was already separated from your mother and living in another state. What did you think would become of you?
I had no idea, Terry, what would become of me. I was completely lost and had absolutely a lot of hope, but no direction, and it was only through music. Music was the agency that music, and going into the military at 14 years old, like I did, was my deliverance.
Now, you enlisted when you were 14.
Right.
How did you forge the papers to get yourself in underage?
Well, I should explain that this was a very, the military of 1946 was a very different military than we know now. It was completely and severely segregated. All blacks were off to themselves and had always been up to that point. So that I wanted to get into this situation of intense learning and intense possibilities for excellence that I had seen in all of these black military men who had gone on before me. And I knew at age 14 that if I could get myself into this group of Army and especially the Air Force, the Tuskegee Airmen, to get among them, because these were the best educated young men in uniform in America, white or black at that time, you see. And I ended up on this all-black Air Force base commanded by a Colonel B.O. Davis, Jr., who was the first, who became the first three-star black general. And it was there that I had all of my opportunities laid before me, shown how to pursue them, tutored by officers, officers' wives, older men, and got out of the Army at 17 and went directly to Yale as a freshman.
Didn't you look a little bit young at age 14? Did everybody get the point that you had forged your way into the military?
I'm sure they did. I looked like a Cub Scout, and I'm sure that also was a part of the great blessing. I was treated as a child. I was not pushed ahead of anything that was possible for me. I was chastised. I was disciplined the way parents discipline children. I was spanked and given beatings when I was bad. I couldn't use ugly words or smoke cigarettes or drink and go out with fast women. I had to wait till later.
So nobody ever tried to discover you and root you out?
Only one. My bandmaster, the first one, Mr. Ruffin, a ward officer, did, simply because he suspected I was too young. And he rode away for my birth certificate and confronted me with it. And I started to cry when he threatened to send me home. And he said I could relax because he had done the same thing. He joined when he was 16, and he had become a musician there, got all of his education through there, had the GI Bill and continued his education. And so that confrontation was another great relief. He took that as an opportunity to step in and supervise my progress from there. And it was largely due to his efforts that I was able to get out when I got out in 1949 and go to Yale.
Huh. Now, you started playing the French horn while you were in the military.
That's right.
You had to talk your way into playing it. Didn't they basically think it was too difficult an instrument?
That's right. I was a drummer when I went in, and there were much better drummers in the band, and it was soon apparent that I couldn't keep up. So they said, well, you got to go back to the infantry outfit. And this was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, 40 degrees below zero outside. And I said, I got to find something in this band that I can learn to play and learn it so I can stay here. And I spotted the French horn. I always loved the sound of it, but I knew how hard it was. And they fought against letting me learn to play it because nobody else there was playing it. And I knew they needed it. And if I got good enough on that, then I wouldn't be displaced again. I wouldn't be kicked out because nobody else was going to come around and play over my head.
Now, nobody wanted to teach you how to play it.
Well, nobody knew exactly, so I had to solicit help from other instrumentalists, baritone horn players and trombonists and clarinetists and flute players and all that. So I was kind of fumbling in the dark, but I was given great instructions on musicality, not technical aspects of the horn. I was taught how to tell a story with music.
Did you basically have to teach yourself from French horn books how to play, since
yes.
nobody in the band knew how to play French horn or could teach you the technique?
Terry, that's exactly it. You hit it right on the head. I had to get a book and start from the beginning, and the book didn't have the fingerings in it. I had to sort of play that by ear, and I didn't know then that there were several possibilities, fingering possibilities for every note on the French horn, and I was choosing the ones that were flatter or sharper or not so well in tune. So by the time I taught myself how to play all the notes, very few of them were in tune.
So was there a point where you had to relearn everything that you had learned?
Yes, indeed. I fell into the hands of a fabulous teacher named Abe Quignaz in Columbus, Ohio, and he started me all over again, and that was a great blessing because suddenly the horn made sense. I could tell a story in tune.
When was the first time you heard how the French horn was really supposed to sound? I don't know if you'd been to symphonies before that or had classical records. And it's not the kind of music you can hear at the local club
or at
the bar. Yeah,
true. I heard it for the first time on records. But then I was attracted to that sound by the sound of a great contralto in my hometown of Sheffield, Alabama, named Miss Celia Appleton. And Miss Celia sounded like the French horn when she sang. And then I discovered that Marian Anderson also did. So these two reasons were enough for me to be so very strongly attracted to the sound of this instrument.
After you left the military, you ended up at Yale University.
Yes.
How did you get in? How did you know how to apply and where to apply to and all that? Were you helped at the military? Did they encourage you to do it?
Well, what happened, Terry, was that I read a jazz magazine in which there was an interview with the great Charlie Parker. And Charlie Parker was asked the question by the interviewer. He said, Bird, if you could do exactly what you wanted to do for the next several years with your musical life, what would you do? And Charlie Parker said, that's easy. He said, there's a little German cat teaching composition at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. He said, I would enroll in school there and sit at Hindemith's feet and learn me some music. That was good enough for me. I didn't know Hindemith's name from anybody else's name, but I knew that if Charlie Parker wanted to study with him, that was very hip. So I asked around and found that indeed Hindemith was there, and I had relatives in New Haven. My sisters and brothers had moved there. So I applied and was given an audition, and the GI Bill took care of the whole thing, the whole undergraduate years and graduate school.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is musician Willie Ruff, who's probably best known for his jazz French horn playing and for his work with Dwight Mitchell and the Mitchell-Ruff duo. And Willie Ruff's just written a new autobiography, and we'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Musician Willie Ruff is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography called A Call to Assembly. You've played with the pianist Dwight Mitchell for how many years now? Long time.
36 years as a duo, and that's not even counting the 3 years we were together in the Army.
Silly question, but what keeps you together? Few marriages last that long.
That's true. I think what keeps us together, the glue that binds, is the strength of our beginnings together in the military. We were taught by the same teachers at the same time. We were learning our craft together in a fabulously supportive environment as teenagers, and we can't get above it.
Now, more than most jazz musicians, a lot of your career has not been in the clubs. It's been in the classroom. It's been abroad.
Yes.
Is that a direction that you chose?
Yeah, absolutely, Terry. We chose this direction early on in our careers. We wanted to have the concert stage. We wanted access to children's concerts. We wanted their ears. We wanted their minds. We wanted to share with them the magic of this fabulous gift that is unique to America. No other country has produced anything like jazz. And it we're so proud of it, and we're so lucky, we think, the Metro Rough Duo, to be in the position to take it around the world and to share it with other audiences, that we can never get enough of it.
I want to ask you a couple of things about your mother. You were pretty young when she died. You were 13.
Right.
She was
45.
And she really seemed, you know, from reading your book, to be the kind of mother who was so dedicated,
yes,
to her family and to instilling in the children a sense of,
yes,
responsibility and the importance of education.
Mm-hmm.
And she died from tuberculosis.
Right.
She also seemed to be the kind of mother who really didn't want the children to know,
mm-hmm,
that she was physically threatened.
Right.
So how did you really comprehend the gravity of what was happening to her?
Well, at that time it was easy to comprehend, Terry, because tuberculosis, or a spot on the lungs, which was a nice way of putting it back then, was the kiss of death. Everybody knew it. It hasn't been eradicated. I understand it's on the rise again now, but in 1945, there was just very little hope for anyone who got a serious case of TB. They, in the South especially, they were going to die, and we knew. Right? I mean, nobody had to tell me that my mama was going to die and that she was dying. I could see it.
Did she have good medical help?
No. The hospitals were so intensely segregated there and in our area, they wouldn't touch a black person in her condition. So she had to go to a teaching hospital in Nashville, Meharry Medical School in Nashville, for treatment, and they finally sent her home to die.
How far was that from your home?
Oh, about 120 miles.
That's a long distance when
That's right. That's a very long distance.
When your mother died, you went to live with your father in Indiana.
Right.
And your parents had been separated for a while.
Since I was just practically born.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So your mother was this kind of pillar of strength and responsibility from the way you describe her. What was your father like?
Well, my father wasn't a pillar of strength and responsibility. He tried hard, but he was a man who was very much affected by his world, and his world was a brutal one. He was damaged by it in spirit and ultimately in body, so that it was clear to me that I would not be able to thrive as a 13-year-old there, and that's why I chose the Army as my deliverance.
Did he know how to take care of you?
No. We lived together in a rented room, and I ate a couple of meals a day, the only meals I got, in restaurants around town. So I went in the Army mainly because I was hungry. As they say down south, I had wrinkles in my belly. I thrived on GI food, all those good potatoes and all, grew like a weed.
Did your father expose you to things that would have been considered dangerous or improper for somebody of your age, but it was pretty interesting?
Yes, my father exposed me to jazz music. Oh, every chance he got, he'd take me out to grown folks' places where they were smoking and drinking and cussing and dancing nasty. I mean, really dirty dancing back then, and I could see these dance halls where expert, fabulous musicians in Evansville, Indiana were playing the varnish off those horns, and it was just the most, that was the thing that he and I shared, this musical fascination with jazz music and the gift of the black American spirit as expressed in music. That was our greatest common bond.
Do you practice your horn anymore?
Oh, Lord, do I ever practice. I spend my life with that thing. I almost sleep with it, eh? And I try to get it better and better and better all the time. I soothe it and call it pretty names. I call my horn Lena. Lena Horn. Because anybody with a name like that and a name of such a pretty woman has to behave.
How many horns do you have?
I have a spare, but it's nothing like Lena.
Is the place you're living in Alabama like a small town?
Oh, yes. I live out in the... I don't even live in a small town. I live out in the woods. Way back out in the woods where the hoot owls court the chickens.
What do you like about living isolated like that?
Peace and quiet, and I can get up out of the bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and practice the horn. And if anybody hears it, they are trespassing.
And it's their problem.
Right.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, again for the invitation.
Willie Ruff's autobiography, A Call to Assembly, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air.